Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Osiris.
Hey Osiris listeners, we want to tell you about our friends at Sunset Lake CBD who support this show. Sunset Lake CBD is a Vermont hemp farm crafting affordable CBD products designed to help with sleep and stress without breaking the bank. If you haven't tried CBD before, take it from me, it's a game changer. I use Sunset Lake's tincture every night before I go to bed, helping me get solid, restful sleep. And their gummies are great for daytime. Check out their new Good Vibes gummies, which have just a bit of hemp-derived THC to help you relax and unwind. Sunset Lake CBD crafts products with hemp grown on their family farm and ships them directly to customers. They have tinctures, salves, edibles, coffee, smokables, and even pet products. By the way, their CBD chocolate fudge is awesome. Check them out today at sunsetlakecbd.com and use coupon code TIME for 20% off all products. Sunset Lake CBD, farmer-owned, Vermont-grown.
Loyalty described as, do you care? And I care, and that's why I'm on this show. Comes a time, here we go.
I'm a sucker for O'Teal, man. It's all that same feeling that I have, that would he fill the void that I didn't even know existed.
It feels so good to, as Ben said, to try to do something about an issue as opposed to complaining.
If you can't help, don't hurt.
If we could just all get out there and throw cream puffs at each other, maybe things, instead of bullets and angry words, it would be better.
When you stop laughing, you stop living.
There's a worldwide surge in interest in mushrooms.
It was deep, man.
It's not that TM makes your mind quiet down there. It already is. We're just stuck up here. We've lost access.
And Jumpin' Jack Flash came out by the Stones. So I thought, all right, perfect, man. I'm going to drive. And I started driving through the neighborhood, and I got a text from Mick Jagger.
People saying that, you know, what we do is non-essential. Well, playing those few gigs that you saw me at felt pretty essential to me.
It wasn't like they were clapping from here. As they were clapping from here.
My view of things is that death is the last and best reward for a life well lived.
Like you gotta, it's the strangest of places if you look at it right, you know?
If you're liking what you're hearing, head on over to patreon.com/comesatimepod and get your bus pass for an extra episode every week.
Welcome back to another episode of Comes a Time Podcast. That is O'Teal.
And that is Mike. And this is my Iron Sheik t-shirt, Sheik 83.
Special shirt. That thing is the beacon. That's the bat signal right now, huh, for you? You keep it just running into the right people thanks to your t-shirt, your wrestling t-shirt collection.
So, as we're recording this, I just found out tonight I'm going to get to have dinner with Brutus the Barber Beefcake and Jim Hacksaw Duggan.
Jim Duggan. Wow.
Two of the most legendary professional wrestlers.
10-year-old me is doing backflips right now for you.
And 10-year-old me is doing, because like it helps me access the 10-year-old me.
I know.
You know,
it's awesome watching
so
this.
Great,
it's so
man.
Fun watching you like get, so you called me, you're like, dude, guess who I met last night? You're so excited. It's great, dude. I'm so happy for you. I told you got to bring you got to go to Home Depot and get a hacksaw for him to sign.
And I gotta get that 2x4, man. Yeah. So some of that's probably going to be coming soon, but today, which it's not when we show this, but today is the actual first day of Black History Month. Mm-hmm. And by coincidence, if you believe in that sort of thing, we had amazing bassist Alphonso Johnson, one of my biggest heroes of all time. You probably saw him playing or heard him with Santana
for those of you that are more into like the old school stuff that I am into, Weather Report, that's where I ran into him. And that band and Alfonso are like direct reason that I'm playing. And you hear his playing and my playing all the time, and always have and always will. And he also played with George Duke, Alan Holdsworth, Chet Baker, Billy Cobham, Hermeto Pascoal, for those of you Brazilian folks that know the heavy stuff. Like, this guy's, he's played with so many people, it's ridiculous. And he's the sweetest. I mean, wasn't that a smooth, he's gentle. He's a gentle person.
You know what kept popping in my head was the quote that, I don't even know if Karina meant to, she said something that popped in that's like branded on my brain, foundational calm.
Yeah.
Like, he's got it.
He does have it. You could tell he got it from his parents, just like Karina got it from hers.
Just like she got it. Yeah. And it just, that, that's what he has. And if anyone's like looking to, you know, who may not know, you know, and also Jazz is Dead. I mean, that's
Jazz,
you know,
and a lot dead. Of
work with Kim Ock and stuff like that. But
they're out right now.
The Weather Report album, I mean, what's the one that's got Cucumber Slumber on it, Oteel? Is that their,
that's a Mysterious Traveler. But and also Black Market and Tailspinning, like
all such fantastic albums. I think
changed my life. Yeah,
that's what got me into like that album. The Cucumber Slumber is just such a, I mean, damn, that song is just incredible. But then Billy Cobham, I mean,
Billy Cobham, George Duke, man, Red Baron. The bass lines this guy wrote, like,
yeah,
man, yeah, take the trip. Those George Duke records, I was about to be in tears because I had to turn it off because we had to actually do the podcast. But, you know, all that stuff just reminded me of sitting in our teeny little music room at home in Southeast Washington.
Yeah.
Listening to George Duke and Alfonso and Dugu, Leon Chancellor together, just like.
I love George Duke from stuff, I love George Duke from all the Zappa stuff. The Zappa, too.
Yeah.
It's just, like just the way that it all kind of.
And Alfonso also played with Weir, with Bobby and the Midnights.
Yep.
He was the Midnight part. Him and Billy Cobham.
Billy Cobham. Yep. Well, and on our Patreon, which is patreon.com/comesatimepod, we'll put a whole bunch of, you know, Alfonso, like we'll put Weather Report. We'll throw up all our favorites. So if you guys want, head over there and we'll be able to, you know, share some of that with you guys. But yeah, this was pretty amazing to, and I like watching you two chat, like, you know, at one point you're like, sorry, and I'm like, what are you apologizing?
I just was like this is the my one I'd Chris love, Farley dude. Moment I was just
please
like,
dude,
so remember when you did the R Will Prevail? That was awesome. You know, I was like, no question.
Remember just, when you were in Weather Report?
That remember wasn't really like Weather, a Report?
Weather Report?
Was oh my it? God.
That was awesome. No, you know what? And I was kind of like, you know, the two of you have had to digest and interpret Phil Lesh. And I'm interested on how that, you know what I mean? Like, that's a super, you have that in common. You know what I mean? And that's a really cool thing that like the two of you have had to kind of both tackle.
You know. I was listening to that early this morning because Pete Lavazzoli, who plays drums with me, sent me something on Archive. So they were doing Weather Report Suite. And it was really, you know, and he plays that space alien. I know this is like the longest intro ever.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Fuck it.
Check keep out the podcast. He plays a space alien instrument called a Chapman stick, built by this cat, Emin Chapman. It has 10 strings on it. And it's like this long, and you don't pluck it. You play both with your hands on it, like a piano.
It's
like
a sitar almost.
It's a crazy, like, yeah. And he uses that with Jazz is Dead, too. And so it's, yeah, go check it out. They just cool finished talk. Up a tour, and I think they're going out again. At some point soon. So
yeah, that was awesome. And look at what a day you're having. Okay. Alfonso Johnson, Now you're going to go beefcake it up. I'm sure you did your DDP yoga today.
I actually didn't today, well, but
you got time in between.
Yeah. Yeah. Alfonso Johnson produced the Barber Beefcake and Hacksaw Jim Duggan in one 24 hour period. That's pretty legendary.
That's a hat trick if I've ever heard it. So we hope you're all having the same kind of day out there, everyone that's listening. So, if you're having fun and you're enjoying the podcast as much as we are, go on and rate it, review it, tell your friends, follow us on our things. We'll have all the links in the bios and stuff. And we got a lot of great episodes coming up. Head back and listen to some of the old ones. They're on our YouTube channel. Join us on Patreon. Take care of each other. Be nice to each other. Stay right. Warm. Stay cool, wherever the hell you are. And dive into an Alfonso Johnson worm. It's a fun listen. And I'd say start with Cucumber Slumber.
That's my favorite. Good one.
Yeah. Have a good day, everyone.
Don't be a jabroni.
Enjoy. Go listen to Alfonso. Bye-bye.
Man, it's good to see you, Alfonso. When was the last time I saw you? It must have been a minute, hadn't it?
Yeah, I want to say it was it in Virginia?
I think so.
Yeah, I think you came by a Jazz at Dead concert and sat in.
Dude, that's a really, really long time ago.
Yeah, it was about 25 years ago.
Wow. Man.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Jazz is Dead is, yeah, wow, huh? 25 years. And isn't it weird how like 2000, the year 2000 still feels like it shouldn't feel like that long ago.
It shouldn't feel like 22 years.
That's what I mean. I think about that and it's like, oh my God, we're getting old.
Yeah. Do we have some kind of Jazz is Dead karma? Because now you're out with Jazz is Dead again and here we are.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
It's true.
Yeah, it was... And it's even crazier when I look out in the audience and I see fans that have grown up with us, with the music, you know,
yeah,
still dancing, and now they have kids in the audience. It's a trip. It's a real trip.
It was funny. A friend of mine down here, who's a fusion guy, you know, he grew up playing. He's really young. He's like 28. Yeah. I think it's 26 when I met him. He grew up playing with all the people down here that live around with Jocko, you know, and played with Jocko back then.
Yeah.
And we were talking.
When you say down here, where are you?
And I'm in South Florida. So I'm 20 minutes from Fort Lauderdale, 45 minutes from Miami. I'm in Boca.
Great.
So he played with a lot of those guys young. And we were talking about you. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, he played with Weir. He was like, what? Really? And I got him a tape. And then you guys went into Bahama Mama, which I missed. I was like, Weir played Bahama Mama?
I know.
Those are my two worlds. Like, that's yours from your solo album, right?
Yeah, we did.
That was so cool.
That was a heck of a band with Weir. You had, I think, Brent in that band as well?
Yeah, Brent, Bobby Cochran, Billy Cobham.
Too much. Right. I went on a, sorry, I'm like going to fanboy. I'm like Chris Farley with Paul McCartney right now. I'll just apologize.
Remember when you played Constitution Hall?
But I just went, you know, I'm up super early like you, Alfonso. Thank you for getting up so early. Or doing this so early. And I just went back and listened to all the old Weather Report and George Duke. And I just went, that's the stuff me and my older brother sat there just dreaming about, you know, like if we could get anywhere near that. And man, I just had such a good feeling hearing all those bass lines. I mean, I always knew how much you influenced me, but going back and listening to like Cucumber's Slumber and all these different things that, you know, I just was like, wow, I steal from you so much.
It's you know, that's the great thing about music, because, you know, the last time I saw the great And excuse me, I have to kind of catch my composure here a little bit. You know, the last time I actually spent time with James Jamerson, I wanted to share with him the same feeling that you just shared, and just how much I was able to borrow from him, steal from him, and let him know that without that foundation, you know, I wouldn't have come up with all that stuff. But it didn't just stop at Jameson, Chuck Rainey, Monk Montgomery, just countless of Tony Williams, you know, playing with Tony changed my bass playing.
Really, I guess so.
Yeah, it really did. In a strange kind of way. So all those, you know, all those musicians, man, we all shared a language, and it's a beautiful thing.
You were extremely young. You know, I go back and I look, it's funny because you looked older to me then, you know, but I was 14.
I was.
Yeah,
I was like,
you know, yeah. Exactly. I mean, actually, I'm younger than that. When I was younger than that. It's because in 1974, I was 10. And now I go back and I see these same album covers and I go, oh my God, look, he was just a kid.
Yeah.
You know, like you were so young, but what you were coming up with, you were one of the main people that taught me to, like, in a jam, come up with a really cool bass line. Like, you don't have to stick to it and, like, make it in stone.
Right.
Do variations off it. Like, it can keep changing ad infinitum, but still, like, find a cool riff, you know? Yeah. And you were just one of the kings of the coolest riffs, you know, bass riffs and grooves that I felt like you just, and, you know, I can't say, I was speculating that you came up with that in the jam. Like, you just,
I got that from Wayne Shorter, because, you know, when you're improvising, Wayne said, it's like you're actually composing, but it's sped up. But when you're composing, it's like you're improvising, but it's slowed down. So
oh, that's neat.
That's so true. That's great.
That's super cool.
That is.
And I mean, I learned so much from Joe and Wayne. It's stupid. I would have paid them to be in that band.
One of those situations, highly skilled though you were. Yeah, I hear you, man. Oh, I can't. I never got to play with those guys.
Oh,
like,
my God.
All my heroes. But
every night was like walking on a tightrope with no net.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
But and at that age, like, how old were you in 74? I mean, you were really young.
Yeah. Well, I was born in 1951.
Yeah.
So you do the math.
Super early 20s, yeah. Wow, man.
Yeah.
That's amazing. That's really amazing.
Your first show, what was, Otil, we talk about your first concert, right? Was at Constitution Hall, right?
Yeah, that's after you left the band.
Yeah, actually, you know, my first concert was June 18, 1968. My first professional gig was June 18, 1968. I walked up on stage. I got my high school diploma. My mom was waiting at the bottom of the stairs, gave me a kiss and said, be safe. I love you. And I went and got in a car with seven other musicians with a U-Haul trailer on it. And we drove 90 miles to Atlantic City to play with an artist named Ronnie Dyson.
Yeah.
Wow.
And high school Ronnie graduate. Dyson, that was my first professional gig. And he was the singer from the film Aquarius.
Ah,
whoa.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm learning that now.
Amazing, amazing voice. But anyway, that was my first gig.
So I want to roll back just a little bit, because I have so much to ask you about. But meeting Jamerson, for those who may not know, James Jamerson is on the Mount Rushmore of bassists, especially electric bass. He played upright as well, like Alfonso does. But, you know, what were the circumstances of you getting to hang with him? Did you... Because you're from Philly, right? And he was based in Detroit. When did you guys hook up?
I was playing a concert in Detroit at, I can't remember the name of the club now, a wine bar or something like that. And I was playing with Billy Paul, who had a big hit single out named Me and Mrs. Jones.
Yeah.
And... during the, you know, back then, in order to especially get the Sunday church going crowd into a club, you had to have kind of a variety of entertainment. So before we went on with Billy Paul, there were these girls and women who were modeling clothes, you know. So the fashion show was going on, and I'm backstage, and in walked this guy, and I was like, this can't be true. this isn't really happening. And then at that point, Norman Farrington, our drummer, said, come on, it's time to go. The fashion show is over. And I just kind of looked back like, oh my God, I can't. So we went and played our set, and when we came back, he was still there. And so I went, man, if I don't say something, I'm going to hate myself for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
So I just went up and I said, I'm sorry, excuse me, sir. Are you Mr. Jameson? James Jameson? He said, yeah. And that started a brief conversation. And, you know, I didn't want to bug him or, you know, be a nuisance. So I just introduced myself and said, you know, how grateful I am for his music and how much, you know, he influenced everything that I do and hope to do. And that was it.
Yeah. People, all of you have heard James Jamerson fans out there. If Motown stuff is ubiquitous, even outer space aliens have heard James Jamerson. It's just a fact. It's a fact. Yeah. You know, but you know, there's like a staggering amount of amazing bass players from Philly. I didn't realize it until someone pointed it out. Yeah. So you probably had, you know, you ever meet Giovanni Collier?
No,
you play with Bruce Hornsby?
No.
Anyway, he had Jamerson's, he told me he had one of Jamerson's B-15s. I was like, how? He goes, he said he was my high school bass teacher.
Oh my gosh.
Your high school? Really?
Yeah.
But you know, you probably had a very similar situation in Philadelphia where like the local guys were like, who were your main mentors? Like, coming up in Philly when you were young?
Well, it would have to be Sherman Ferguson, who was the drummer, and Eddie Green, the keyboard player, and Victor's father, Bailey.
Oh, that's right. His dad did play too.
Can't think of his name right now. But they had a band called Catalyst. And they kind of took me under their wing. And it was kind of almost like you being with the Colonel, right? You could play anything goes.
Ah.
But there was a a structure to what they were doing where you had to catch certain themes and then you go, oh, yeah, we're playing that song now.
Exactly. You know? That was exactly like the Crow.
And it just opened my ears like I never could imagine, you know, that just anything is possible in the music, you know.
And how old were you about then?
I was still, I hadn't graduated high school, so maybe about 16, 17.
Wow. Time. What a great age to start high flying.
Like, yeah, yeah.
You know, I met the Colonel around 24, but like, yeah. Well, I did have Kofi.
So, yeah.
But still, like that kind of like the wide open thing at 16, that's pretty heavy.
Yeah. Well, I had no idea. I mean, I had harmony and theory training from my orchestral playing in junior high school, but still, that was a whole different thing.
And what made you want to switch to electric and fretless and all that?
That's an interesting story. I had an offer from a group called the 3 Degrees.
Yeah,
I remember that. And their manager approached me, you know, and said, you know, they're looking for a bass player to do some dates with them. And, you know, would you be interested? So I said, yeah, you know. Gave me more money than I could ever imagine, $350 a week, you know. And when I told my mom, she was just, what? I said, yeah, mom, I think I've made it. You know, because I could not only help out with the rent, I could now buy myself some stuff.
Yeah. You know? Steady
money. I went to H Street Music in Philly, and the first thing I saw was this blonde bass, you know, and I thought, wow, I'm going to get that bass. And it just happened to be a fretless bass, but, you know, I didn't really think about, you know, scale length and the difference. I play upright, so I must be able to play electric fretless. So I bought that bass, and the first day of rehearsals was a rude awakening because the intonation was so different. So I'm reading music, trying to make corrections, and you know, their manager says, "You're gonna be okay." I said, "Yeah, yeah, I'll get it." So I just practiced like the Dickens. You know, I took the charts home, and that was my first gig on fretless bass.
Wow, you started on fretless. That makes sense. That makes sense. Mike, I don't want to hog the whole conversation.
Are you kidding me? I'm loving this. No, I'm absolutely loving this. Please keep going. I just wanted to interject and say that, like, you know, you mentioned something, Alfonso, about, and we've all experienced it. I got to experience it with stand-up comedy. When you're taken under, when someone takes you under their wing as a young performer or as someone that's not as seasoned, there's a weird responsibility, I think, that kind of comes with it. It's like, I have to start, like, not that you weren't, not that we won't, don't take it seriously before, but it's like, someone's paying attention to me now.
Yeah.
Like, it brings a certain sense of like, okay, like I need to step it up. It's almost a fear of messing up kind of comes along with it. Right.
That's right. That's right. Still.
I know.
Yeah. That's right. I mean, you know, it's true. You're right. It's like they became my other family, and also kind of like my substitute fathers, you know. And in that sense, there was a big responsibility for, I better not mess this up, you know. And even today, you know, with playing with Jazz Is Dead, you know, I have to have I have all the music on an iPad that I constantly keep in front of me because, and excuse me, Bobby, excuse me, Steve, excuse me, Pete, but sometimes things get a little convoluted in the music.
Wouldn't be the Dead without that, right?
I have to be the one to, sometimes to go, here's where we really are. You know, and sometimes I'm guilty of it. I'll think, oh, we're here. And then I'll hear somebody else go, no, we're actually here. So it's, you kind of want to allow the music to happen in the moment and not be so tied down.
Yeah.
But also, as Atul probably knows more than anybody, there are moments when you kind of know where we're headed for a train wreck. Somebody kind of needs to step in and go, I don't know where you guys are, but here's where I am. And if they follow you, that's an acknowledgement of, okay, we're going to go with you.
You're the conductor. You jump on that e-brake.
Sometimes I could do that. You never know when. I kind of look to Jeff Cementi.
Yeah.
You know, because sometimes you could tell it's headed off the tracks.
Yeah.
And they want it to be.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, we're going to completely go into a free spin. So I'm like, on purpose or not on purpose? You know, here's a one, and they're like, on purpose. I'm like, all right, okay, I'll free float with you.
That's hilarious. Are we doing this on purpose?
Yeah.
I mean, and it's great to never know, because it's, again, like that thing we were talking about. You said you're one of your first formative experiences in mind with the Colonel, where you never know.
Yeah.
And that really is like life. Like, you really don't ever know.
That's
ever.
Right.
That's when you said, you know, still, I'm like, yeah, in every part of life. You just have to be ready to roll with it. I got to tell you one funny thing. When I got a fretless once, and I could not, for all, every fiber of my being, no matter what happened, I sounded exactly like you. I'd listen to tapes back of being Kofi, and I was like, you're doing it again. And I'd be like, this time I'm not going to do it. I'm just going to play what I'm hearing in my head, and it would come out like you. And I was just like, I had to sell the bass. Or it was a neck. I put a fretless neck on one bit, and I just like, I let it go. I don't know if I gave it away or sold it. I just like, it's impossible.
Man, that's funny. You should find that instrument.
If I could get that. Well, I have a fretless now, and now I can like force myself more. But this was like, I was 17, 18.
Yeah.
And it was like, fine. Everybody was trying to sound like Jaco. And I was like, you know, let me. And I was stuck sounding like you. I was like, if you can't sound like yourself, just stop. Yeah. Just stop. Yeah. You know,
I can relate to that. After I left Weather Report and Jaco joined the band, Jaco was everywhere. You know, you couldn't hide from him. He was like everywhere. And so, you know, I already knew that I had established a sound of my own, but I purposely stayed away from playing harmonics.
Yeah,
playing certain licks that I knew that he played, you know, just to kind of keep my sanity and my own identity.
Yeah. Well, your sound was so defined already. And there's not that many guys to me that really stick out like in three notes. I can tell who it is on fretless.
Yeah.
It was you, Jaco, and Percy Jones.
Yeah.
This cat from England that just had such a.
Yep.
A different sound, like you know, you're like, that's Percy. Nobody does that shit but Percy.
Who did he play with?
He played with Phil Collins, who you also recorded on Phil's first solo album, right? Phil had a fusion band called Brand X.
Yep.
Oh, wow.
Actually, did Daryl Sturmer play? No, it was...
Actually, Daryl was playing with Jean-Luc Ponty.
That's it.
And
that's it.
When I went to audition for the gig with Genesis and didn't get the gig, I said, you should call Daryl Sturmer, because I knew Daryl also played bass as well as guitar. And so I'm pretty sure that's how Mike got touch with Daryl.
So that was a gig that you weren't playing bass on. You were playing.
They wanted me to play Chapman Stick.
Yeah. You got to tell our fans about Chapman Stick. Like, I don't even know where to begin on that. It's a, yeah. When we saw that instrument, we already thought you were from outer space. We was like, he's part ET, you know. We just, all our favorites are and were.
That's a
then when you pulled that down, honor. I saw that thing. I was like, what is that? It has way too many strings. Like,
yeah, definitely, definitely. Well, it's a 10 string touch board. And let me see, I don't have it plugged in right now, but I can show you.
Yeah, just when people just see it, they'll be like, oh, okay, I get it.
10, like, 10 strings.
You don't have to hear it.
And it's got five bass strings that you play that I play with my left hand, and five melodic strings that I play with my right hand. So what makes it valuable to me as a composer is when I arpeggiate in the left hand, I can play chords that are right under my fingers. You know, yeah. I can play like dominant seventh chords or major triad chords, you know, and augmented chords. And it's not like with the bass is tuned in fourths, but these are tuned in fifths with the lowest string on the bottom. So it's kind of a different way of thinking about bass. Yes. And then the melody strings being tuned in fourths, I can readily grab triad chords right under my three fingers. But in addition to that, there's a new record that I'm on where I'm playing some stick parts where I'm playing like almost like guitar arpeggios.
Yeah.
I'm doubling what the guitar player is doing. But because my strings are lower, I can double his lines by the first three notes being like a bass playing them, but then the top two notes being like a guitar player. So it kind of creates a different kind of sound.
Wow.
And,
people, can you turn it horizontally so people can see like how long it is? Yeah.
Whoa, look at that.
So you don't pluck it like guitar. You're playing both like hands on the fretboard like a piano. Yeah.
It's like a guitar.
So it's percussive in nature.
Yeah.
I've seen some people play it with a pick, like strum it. And
I never saw that.
For me, the traditional way is to just use your tap touch with your finger.
Yeah.
That's such a thick neck, too.
10 strings?
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
This one is called a rail board because it's made out of it's not wooden. It's all graphite material.
Make it lighter.
It's a little heavier, actually, but really? I like it because it's got AMG on it.
Yeah.
It's like it's got guitar pickups, and I got a nice Fender Bassman. I don't know if you remember those old Fender Bassman amp, which is kind of really well suited for this instrument.
It's funny because it's such a futuristic guitar for extraterrestrials, and you run it through an old 60s Bassman. With the old, Buck Rogers tubes.
Wow.
That's true.
I want it right after we're done. I want to listen to some,
check his solo albums out because that stick, it's very different.
I wonder if I've heard it. I must have heard it and not known,
Actually, the best, I always say the best recording of the stick is on YouTube.
Yeah.
And if you look up my name with Chapman Stick, it'll take you to a concert I did with when I was playing with Santana. And nice. We do a ballad from the movie The Deer Hunter called Cavatina, written by John Williams. And that's probably the best because you can hear me playing solo. And then when the band comes in, you can hear me playing with the band.
Yeah.
That's cool. Awesome. I'm definitely going to check that out right after. That's such a neat instrument. Wow.
They just added Santana to the like long list. In the intro, I'll go to the like incredibly long list of people you played with.
Well, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask the two of you. The dead geek in me has to ask the approach and the you know, from a composer standpoint, from a player standpoint, from a just the ear approaching Phil Lesh and approaching the way that you both kind of can, you're seeing it from different angles, you're approaching it from different angles, different venues, different. I'd just like to know your thoughts on him as a composer, as a, you know, how to approach that, like, kind of wild, you know, mad scientist type play.
Yeah. Go ahead. Okay, I'm going to let you go first.
Well, I mean, the people on my podcast have heard me talk about it a bunch, but, you know, just real quickly, it's like he's from the things that I come from, especially jazz, Colonel Bruce, all these things that allow you to break rules or not be confined by the most constricting rule of the rules. Which, you know, people just like, I just want you to play bass. Just give me the root and the four and the five. And, you know, I like to play counter melodies and stuff. I love bass subs. I love changing the chords. And Phil, yeah, I mean, that's his philosophy. Never do it the same way once. Yeah, so,
yeah.
And it does put pressure on you to continually evolve. Like if you do it, if you find something really cool and you do it too much, now it's wrong. Yeah. It's like you got to keep changing it. So I would listen to him like every decade, same song. He just keeps changing it. He done up to right now.
Yeah.
You know, so then I was just like, okay, well, just play it like yourself because you can't play it like him. And he'll keep changing it. So you'll never put your finger on it, you know.
Hey there, Osiris listeners. I wanted to tell you about our friends over at Smart Wool. For more than 25 years, Smart Wool has been making merino wool socks and apparel designed to keep you comfortable. Because they want to help you play, laugh, and explore in the outdoors with every thread they knit and every step you take. Because they believe that comfort sharpens focus and lets you perform beyond your limits. They are here to help you feel good. Now, it's up to you how far you will go. Take 15% off of your first order at smartwool.com. Smart Wool. Go far, feel good.
I guess my approach when we first put Jazz Is Dead together, I had never really listened to the Grateful Dead's music from an analytical point of view. You know, to have to like, okay, we're going to play these songs. How do we play them and make jazz arrangements? So when I heard the music, you're right. It was like Phil Lesh didn't already landed on one, didn't like playing the roots of the chord, you know. So that kind of freed me up to do my own thing.
Yeah. And
so my approach is more from a Philly R&B pocket kind of way of thinking. You know, I always play the one when the chord changes. And I like to use the call and response African approach to creating the bass line. I'll play something and then I'll respond to it.
Yeah.
And play something, you know. And then try to have that evolve throughout the song. So I might do it to establish the verse. And then when the bridge comes, I'll switch to something else. But it's always usually call and response. And lately, I've been finding myself taking more risk with it, you know. So now that those guys know, now that we all know each other musically, you know, I can turn things around, not play on the downbeat or, you know, play five against four, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, sometimes Kamak will look over at me like, what's he doing?
And I'm mission like, accomplished.
You've got his look down too. It's like,
Don't worry, in 20 measures it's gonna make sense, you know. So that kind of thing.
I heard this incredible story about Wilco. They did a thing called Philco, where it was Phil and friends and some of the members from Wilco and Nels Klein. A virtuosic guitar player. They're playing one of Wilco's songs via Chicago. And there's a part of the song where Nels just goes, like the band just goes completely insane, but Jeff Tweedy, the singer, stays in the like kind of country-ish sort of rhythm. And they just, he's just going out of this, like just possessed. And I guess Phil kind of looked up like he got Phil's attention, and you can just hear Phil go, huh, and just sort of laugh while he's playing. So it's just like, you know, to break the prankster a bit was kind of like cool, you know, to see that happen. I think about the intuition that Garcia had, where he said to Phil, you're going to be the bass player in this band. And he never played bass. Like, that's just such an incredible, like he knew he had that in him. So maybe that changed the way that he even approached. There was no preconceived notions, you know, maybe that freed him up.
There's a great, amount of responsibility, but also that's a great word, freedom. When you're asked to play music and there's no bass line, somebody else didn't already come up with the part, you know?
Yeah.
And, the only other time I've had that was with a group called Abraxas Pool, mm-hmm. which was Greg Raleigh, Neil Schoen, Michael Sharif, Chipito, Michael Carabello, where they had these songs. And when we went in to record, they had already had, I can't think of the bass player's name from Journey.
I should know this.
Yeah.
I apologize. Too.
But anyway, he had recorded, and I said, I don't want to hear the bass.
Yeah.
And Neil was like, you know.
Go fresh.
Neil is a big, big fan of, give us what you have to say, you know, come up with your own thing. And that was the only time I really was in a group, I mean, other than Catalyst, where there was no preconceived idea about the bass line. However, this new record that I just did with Unitopia is probably the second time that I've been asked to, okay, here are the songs, come up with your own bass part. And of course, there were always these suggested parts by the keyboard player, but
yeah,
it's like, I'm not going to play like that. I'm sorry. I'm not going to do that. Yeah.
Well, they're different instruments. They don't... you know, it's like more extreme than different languages. Like different languages, they all come out of mouths, you know.
Yeah.
But a piano is just completely different than a bass guitar. So it's not, you can't. I mean, there's like some people that can kind of do it like Stevie Wonder and Neil Evans from Soul Live and that have this keyboard bass thing.
Yeah.
You know.
I even look at the Doors. I mean, like that's just such a strange approach where the key is play. That's the bass in the band. Odd.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a couple of things I want to ask you about that are themes of our podcast. One is mental health and the other is anomalous experiences or paranormal experiences, which I think we have a lot of in jams, because you get when things start getting very telepathic, you're like, oh, what's going on here?
Yeah.
But mental health first, you know, you've had your career started really early, like graduate high school. See you, Mom.
Such an awesome story. I love it. And,
then
skip college.
And you were doing really big stuff really early. How are you so still sane, nice, physically healthy. Like, you know, a lot of people lose one or alive, you know, lose one or multiple or all of those things.
It wasn't always on a straight trajectory, you know. First of all, my upbringing, you know, my family raised me from a Baptist church perspective. I always went to Sunday school with my little hat on and my little tie and my jacket, you know. And so that foundation never leaves you, you know, no matter what happens in life. But, you know, I must admit, when I got to go out on tour with people like Santana and these other big groups, I was not always sane, you know. I didn't always do things that would have supported that image that people had of me, you know. And I think those experiences are valuable too, because, you know, we can't go back and live in the past, because life is a forward moving event. But you can learn from things that we call mistakes or experiences and carry those forward, whatever they are, whether it's music or relationships or, you know, the things that happen during our lives. So, and to turn that into the mental health aspect is, we are always evolving as a human being, and we have to accept that evolution. There's a great film about this. It's a kind of a science fiction movie with Scarlett Johansson, and she plays this character, and the whole film is about how it all starts from one cell and how that cell splits into two and how those two cells are communicating, and then it keeps going. And we can kind of relate that to the universe. Everything, all matter is composed of cells, but they all relate to each other. So something that happened here in my music room is being shared over the air with Oteil in his room and Mike and Eric and all the people that are going to watch this. And it all connects us, you know, that swirl that we look at sometimes when we look at the solar system. It looks like this gigantic thing. We're all like grains of sand, each one of us. So when you go to the beach, you can imagine how many pieces of sand are connected to each other. And we're all like that. We're all connected. And when the water comes in and moves the sand and washes it away, we're all affected by it, you know? Mm-hmm. And so to me, that's the mental health aspect of it for me. Is I just try to be as fluid as possible and accept things that are happening, whether I think they're good or bad or whatever. I just kind of go with it, you know. And that's kept me alive for these past 70, tomorrow will be 72 years.
Happy Your birthday's tomorrow?
Thank you, yeah.
Groundhog Day. Happy birthday. 72, man, you do not look it. You know,
definitely not.
No, because it's, you know, a fair amount of my heroes have died early, you know, way back, you know, the old jazz guys and stuff. And I've always looked to the guys that had that longevity, You know, I got to see Dizzy Gillespie very old. I got to see Buddy Rich when he's very old, Sonny Stitt. Yeah. You know, I got to, they all died right after that. I almost quit going to see people. But, you know, you and Chuck Rainey, and there's a Willie Weeks. There's these people I know that just have this longevity. They're still very sweet, very nice. And it's like, wow, you didn't let, because a lot of the people, they, God bless them. They either lost the nice part, the sane part, the physical health part, or all the above, except for their life. You know, there's
it's not an easy career.
I feel sorry for him. That's like Norwood Fisher sweatshirt said, being human is a full time job. There's no clocking out. And so you need to have that, like what you said, Alfonso, like life is a forward moving event. If you can learn from, but also leave some stuff in the past. Keep moving forward.
There was a really great Fela Kuti quote that I've been looking for, that I had taken a screenshot of, and I'm going to keep looking because I want to find it and read it to you. But it fits right in with that, where it's like our mistakes are our learning points. Like they're the, you know, you need them.
If they don't kill you, if they don't kill you, like, and now that I have kids, I'm like, yes, I know you have to make your own mistakes. Stepping out into traffic on the highway is not one of them. You know, like, then we gotta. Sorry.
There has to be boundaries.
There has to be. You know, I hate authority. You know, like I've realized when Garcia said, you know, the Grateful Dead, everybody in this band were pathologically anti-authoritarian. I was like, that's why I'm in this band. I just do not like the rules, you know.
Here's this Fela Kuti quote: everything I did wrongly was for experience. That's how I see it. Once a man is looking for a better knowledge and he tries to be honest and truthful in all endeavors, then his life is just an experience. It cannot be a regret.
That's true,
which is really interesting, right? You know, because you can beat yourself up forever about the mistakes, but if you go, I'm not that person now.
If you could be honest and truthful about it after the fact, all my pursuits were not so noble. But I'm a wild man. That's just part of my, you know.
But
whatever.
You know, too. That's a. That I'm glad you said that. That's part of it too. You know, I mean, that when you become a risk taker, it doesn't stay with playing the bass. It's when you leave the stage, you're still that person, you know, and that's what you bring to the music, you know, when you write songs or when you play the instrument or when you sing, you know.
So now I have to remind myself of that with my son, because my son is like, you know, I want to do it differently, and he'll do it great. And I have to let him do it. It's teach. It's not. Well, I wouldn't think it's natural for me to be authoritarian. It's come a little bit more naturally than I'm comfortable with. Like, cut it out. You know? I'm like, oh, man, I don't want to be a bully. You know what I mean? But I also realize, like, Oteil, this is, like you said, Alfonso, this way that you are, since it didn't kill you, is very useful in music, if you can get it controlled in the other parts of your life. And all these within the boundary of, like, well, we're all doing this together. So if I'm being so wild that now it's hurting how other people are playing, well, then now I'm not doing it right. Same with light. And I got to let Nigel's teacher said, he goes to a Montessori school, so they're out of the box anyway. She said, well, he's not, nor I was like, yeah, I know, he's different. We have three levels of desks. So he prefers to stand. So he doesn't want to be made to sit down in one place. But they said his favorite is all the way on top of the highest desk, like laying on top of it, like doing his work. And they said, we let him do it. And his work is like at the top of the class. He focuses. But if you make him sit down, he can't, like, but if you just let him, like, you know. So I was like, okay, Oteil, this is your son. Like, don't, you know, you got to let him.
Yeah, dude, you do.
Karma boy, karma. To reap just as you sow, right?
Yeah. Well, there's also authoritarian, but what I hear is like, you know, if you know the person that the authorities come, if that like, hey, cut it out, is coming from someone who also says, I love you.
Yeah.
It's you. Yeah. You go, okay, that guy cares about me. He doesn't
I think
want
that's more of a feeling with him than a thought.
Sure.
Because the thought is,
that jerk.
Shut up. You know.
The thought is, the second this dumb dumb leaves the room, I'm doing it twice.
But that's right.
The hard thing, though, he knows deep down, that guy loves me. He's not yelling at me. He, you know.
Karma. It's beautiful. It's actually perfect. It's beautiful. I'm glad for all the everything. What a learning experience, man.
Think about how many people would have ended up different if they were allowed to lay on the top of their desk. How many of us like had to just like sit still, shut up, don't do this, don't do that, don't scribble. I always thought, you know, there was like this whole, like, I remember there being like schools were mad about graffiti outside the school. And I always thought, how about we donate a wall inside the school?
Yeah. Just let's do it.
Yeah. Like maybe you're considering it rebellion because they don't have like, no, there's no place for that. Like
it'll
outlet.
Provide a place for it to happen. Who knows what kind of beautiful artwork would have come of it.
Right. How many Warhols and all this are stifled at whatever years old and they're told like sit down and be quiet and they're not able to. Yeah, man.
I think about that with Hitler. Cause I saw somewhere recently that Hitler got rejected at art school. He didn't get in. I was like, what if he got in and just was able to get all that shit out painting? You know, like the whole friggin' world would have been different if someone had a little bit more of an open mind and said, oh, come on.
God, who knows?
You know, like, geez, man.
You know, it's interesting that people talk about Hitler, but we never get to learn, like, who his parents were, what his upbringing was, you know, what are all that other stuff that affected.
Yes.
Yeah.
I find it interesting in the Bible, this concept that you don't have enough information about a person to judge them. Only God does.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I think about that, like when Trump was running, because now I have little kids. I've watched my kid go from a lump to a beautiful, pure, just loving being. And I was like, if we saw Trump as at like 3 and we couldn't tell it was him.
Yeah.
Cause he doesn't look like what he looks like now yet. Right.
Yeah.
That kid is like hanging out with my kids, being a beautiful kid. Now, I don't know what happened along the way, but it's probably the same with Hitler. Some people have a rough start straight from the beginning, and that's clearly possible. And a lot of those people end up really nice. So that's I don't know, but I suspect there was a point when they were just pure and good and beautiful, beautiful little children, you know? And like you say, Alfonso, we never think about that. Yeah. We think about the asshole that we hate. You know? We think about
easy with those two.
I mean, it is, you know, history that we evolve keeps moving forward, but right. I try to think about it. I try to think about it with a bunch of people.
and it's so interesting about how like it's been portrayed in movies pretty good, where it's like you see the, when you look at the person, you picture the little kid inside of them. Or like, you know, I remember there was like one of the comic book movies where it's like every time, I forget who it was, some villain, every time he looks in the mirror, he sees like a overweight kid. And like, that's the whole thing. Like he's him to himself. So he's like, his perception is the reality, right?
Yeah.
It's interesting to think about that. Yeah. Like, is Trump still some kid that got like his lunch money taken?
Yeah.
You know, or whatever. And now he's like, no one's taking my money. You can't see my taxes.
Oh God. It's...
Who the hell knows?
We've got to stop bullying. Bullying can save the bullying. You know?
I was that kid. They tried to take my lunch money.
Really?
Billy's rough, man.
I just knew if I let this happen, it's never going to stop. So I kind of drew a line in the sand, took my hat off, and we went at it.
Nice. I never pictured you that way. I pictured you just like the piece of the... What sign are you, man?
Aquarius.
Oh, that's what my son is. What day?
February 2nd. Tomorrow.
Oh, duh. Tomorrow, February 2nd. Duh. Yeah. Awesome. Oh, my son's an Aquarius. Yeah, he's a fighter survival. Too, man. Yeah.
That's not picking a fight. That's survival. Oh, what you were doing, Alfonso. You had to say, like, it's going to keep happening.
Yeah.
Do you have any children?
I have three. Yeah, I have three beautiful children. I have my oldest son, Miles. He'll be 37 this year.
Awesome.
My daughter, Lori, she'll be 36. My youngest son, Malcolm, will be 35.
Man, you did a... My mom said, potty train him before you have another one. You went bam, bam, bam. You were like, let's get it out the way.
Yeah. You know what I'm just realizing? I met you the last time I met you back. It was at the Mercury Lounge when you with Steve Kimmock back in, it must have been Mercury Lounge, 2001 maybe.
What city is that, Mercury?
New York City.
Oh, okay.
And I met you with my buddy Justin, whose birthday is the same as yours, February 2nd. His birthday's tomorrow as well. And I just put that together and I was like, wow, that's weird. That.
Happy birthday, Justin.
It was a 4th of July weekend. I remember catching you guys at I think it was Mercury Lounge, but.
That was a great band.
So much fun.
Yeah, we were talking. I was talking to Steve's wife, Jennifer, about that and just with Rodney and Mitch, how they were able to, it was like two bands, like Steve and Mitch wouldn't play the same chord voicing. So it almost sounded like one guitar. And then Rodney and I had that polyrhythmic thing going where, you know, we would always keep mixing it up. So we weren't playing like a pocket. It was like two pockets. Yeah. And that was great. That was great.
Such a fun band. Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
That early 2000s stands out to me as kind of like such a, like it's a weird kind of like advent of so many great collaborations and so many bands and so many festivals.
Yeah.
And like that whole jam scene, I feel like it was like a really big moment for that scene. Like Bonnaroo happened for the first time and so much happened in that very early 2000s to 2000, like 4 or 5. You could just go see phenomenal music all over the place. It was like popping up in different cities and everyone was playing with everyone. It was a lot of fun.
It's crazy how many periods like that you have been a part of, Alfonso, from from the late 60s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, 2000s.
You're due.
Very, very, very blessed, man. I hear this a lot, you know, another day above ground, but it's so true, you know, like you never know what's going to happen and you just welcome each day with like, wow. All right, let's do this, you know?
Yeah, you got the best spirit. All right, one last question. I don't want to keep you too long.
All right.
About the anomalous stuff, because it happens to me all the time. It always did. I met Colonel Bruce. It turned up to 11. Now I feel like it's heating up again, like a lot of people that really actually didn't. They just didn't see it, you know, and now they're like, hey, man, what the hell? Have you ever had, I mean, I figure most people that are raised in church at least believe in the possibility of the paranormal and the anomalous, but have you actually had experiences of some sort with it?
No, I have weird dreams, but I've never had a paranormal experience. And I don't know if that's a good thing or not, but.
Well, they're not all good. Like some people have had bad ones and, but there's all different kinds, you know, like I dream into the future. Some people, a friend of mine, a close friend of mine who did not believe in mystical stuff, didn't say it doesn't happen, but just like, I never seen it happen. And she almost died, and her parents came to her. And so she called me. She was like, yo, I know you believe in this stuff. She's like, I believe it now, bro. I was like, all right, we'll talk, you know, when you feel a little better. She's a kind of a long story, you know? And I was like, I want to get it all. So it's, I think a lot of people that have deja vus dream into the future, but they can't remember their dreams. And I can, because it starts like a deja vu, but then I remember.
Yeah.
Oh, I dreamed that, you know?
Well, just, you know, Bobby Lee Rogers and I have these conversations where we talk about how, you know, we live in a three-dimensional world, you know, that has height and width and depth to everything. You know, when we look around, we see that in all of our inanimate objects, but we also kind of see it, like, for instance, when we're traveling, you know, we assume that when we fly from Chicago to Boston, that we're going to get there. You know, we plan that we're going to go down to baggage claim, get our luggage, go to the hotel, check in. You know, it's all like we've projected that. But in fact, it's already happened. You know, that these events that happen in our life, it's already taken place. You know, it's just that we are in the present moving through it. So when we get to sound check, for instance, and Steve and Pete will play a lick at the same time, we just kind of look at each other and go, see, there it is. That already happened, you know?
Yeah.
That was meant to happen. And so we're kind of moving through this world in an interesting kind of way, because we're like actors in this play that we call our life, you know?
Yeah.
And so we're following these events as they unfold before us, and we'll keep unfolding until we reach a point where that will change, and that will be part of what's going to happen as well.
Yeah.
So that would be my probably ESP moment.
Yeah.
Just realizing that, wow, this interview had happened even before I got back home from walking in, you know?
The whole thing is a paranormal along the spectrum experience.
That's it. That's what it is to me, because it's the fact that you could leave home and picture your room that you're sitting in as it is while you're halfway across the world.
Yeah.
Just that you can retain that.
Yeah.
Or like all the scientists coming out of the closet about it now, because they're starting to recognize, or maybe something happened to them. And it's just like, hey, no matter what is three-dimensional, there's still the observer observing it. There's still the measure measuring it. So what is that?
I call it,
you know, that we're aware of being aware.
Yeah.
Well, and also, like Alfonso, you're talking about like walking to baggage claim, right? Like, what are you in someone else's experience of walking from baggage claim?
That's right. Yeah.
So it's a whole collection of paranormal things.
The whole thing is.
Hey, I just remembered the name of that film that I was talking about. It's called Lucy.
Lucy.
And let's, it's with Scarlett Johansson. And it starts on the premise, you know, about the cell splitting, but it also lays out this timeline of, you know, we're human beings. We have a brain, but we only use 10% of its capacity, potential, right?
Yeah.
I mean, but But what would happen if we could use 15% of that brain? And they kind of lay out the scenario in the movie, what happens, and then 20%, and then 25%. So at a certain point, we would actually be able to transcend the human body as far as being able to affect things. Like, at a certain point, rather than me picking up this coin and putting it back, I would be able to move it over here and place it back.
See, you know? He's like, well, I've never had anything paranormal happen, but you sure think that way.
I gotta watch that movie. That's a fun movie.
And yeah, isn't it a funny coincidence that as we were talking about it, you're like, oh, I remember the name of the movie now.
See, that already happened.
There you go.
Right. All right.
There it is.
The defense rests. Man, Alfonso, wow. It's so nice when you meet your heroes. I met you a long time ago, but I'm sure you've had it happen where sometimes, yeah, they say you don't want to meet your heroes, but man, you, Wayne Shorter, Elvin Jones, Roy Haynes. George Porter, I could go, mwah, mwah.
Yeah.
Digaboo mode, Lesty. Mwah. Thank you. Thank you for being so sweet.
I reconnected with George Porter, and you're right. He is such a sweetheart.
Man, him, Willie Weeks. Oh,
yeah.
Sweet, man. So sweet.
I'm happy to be here, and I'm very glad that we were able to reconnect.
Me too.
And let's stay in touch.
We will. We won't wait. Hopefully Jazz's dad will keep doing more stuff because that seems to be our,
our
cross up. So, thank you so much for doing the podcast. You're a beautiful
pleasure
soul,
to meet you, and happy birthday. Happy birthday.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike. And thank you, Eric, for taking good care of us while we're here on air.
That's right. And
thank you.
Yeah. Today's the first day of Black History Month. So here you go, folks. Some of the sweetest, most loving Black history that you could get.
Top shelf.
All right.
That's right.
Take care. Man.
Thank you. All right. Have a great week.
Osiris.